The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Church is a great gift. Its roots, its foundation is such that nothing can shake it. You've given us a kingdom that cannot be shaken. We can be shaken, but not your kingdom. We thank you that you've made us members of your kingdom, that you've made us a community of your kingdom. We thank you that you've made us agents of your kingdom. And we pray that in some small ways we might be better equipped to function in all of those ways because of our time of study and reflection here this morning. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
All righty, let me recap our the trends that we've been charting. And what I want to do is three things today. Let me recap the trends. I mean, I've already given it to you in a number of different ways, a number of different lists. Then I want to talk a little bit more, because I really rushed at the end of last session, a little bit more about the family, the way the family is changing, and a little bit about the economy of contrast. I didn't talk too much about that. Then what I want to do is discuss implications of this for the doctrine of the church, for the way in which the church operates. And we should have time for discussion, I think. So let me just remind you of what the trends are. There's a lot of ways to add them up, but I've already said we have talked about the secularization of the public sectors of our society, how religion and metaphysical values have been utterly jettisoned from the public sectors, and religion is something only for the private world. We've talked about technology. It's intruded into every area of life. Technology is being used to address every problem in all areas of life. We're in the information age. We've talked about radical individualism, and an awful lot of what we said falls under radical individualism. Individuals find meaning not outside of themselves, not in any social roles, not in any other institutions, right? But we find our reality, we find our meaning and identity in our freedom to jettison any covenant, and the freedom to choose. Freedom of choice is the absolute value. Freedom of choice. We said that there's a growing distrust of experts, there's a growing distrust of bigness, of centralized things. There's a tendency toward entrepreneurship, self-government, litigation, self-help, you see, decentralization, post-standardization, political fragmentation. There's a leadership vacuum. All of that comes under radical individualism. We've talked about cultural pluralism. Now, they go together. All these things go together. But we're saying that Anglos in this country are quickly, though nobody can agree on how fast, they're quickly becoming a minority among slow-melting or non-melting ethnics. There was a book not too long ago called The Rise of the Unmeltable Ethnics. And the fact is that, you see, because we live in an individualistic society, and also because immigration is so great, the old idea of the melting pot, America being a melting pot, is going by the boards. We also have to realize that the old melting pot, the old ethnics, were Germans and Northern Europeans, German Scandinavians, British, you know, that was the old ethnics. And they melted pretty well, you see, for all kinds of reasons. But the rise of the unmeltable ethnics is a fact of our time. So, cultural pluralism. We've talked about the hunger for meaning and experience. Great hunger for intimacy, for getting rid of the impersonal, the bureaucratic, moving toward relational approaches and the personal. And we've also talked about the dominance of image. Image is more important, appearance is more important than ideas, you see. Leisure is more important than work. That's how we find our meaning. We've talked about the dominance of leisure and image. We just said that. We've talked about the fact that the world is becoming a city-centric world. Now, this is something I really mentioned The very first day I talked about the fact that the third world is still urbanizing. A lot of people will say that the developed countries aren't urbanizing anymore. And if you look closely at the statistics of the cities of America, most of the large cities of America are losing population in the city limits. But that's a little bit of a misunderstanding. Ray Bakke, who's a leading urbanologist, says that in the developing countries, in the third world, the cities are still growing. That is, people are moving in. That is, everyone is pouring into the center, and they're still growing in the most basic sense. But in the Western world, the cities are spreading out. I'd coin a phrase like this: not so much urban. They're not urbanizing, but they're metroing. That is, the metropolitan areas are all growing, most of them in America. The greater metropolitan areas are growing, not the cities within the city limits. Why is that? Partly because of high tech. There's not as much of a need for people to all live on top of one another, and yet, you see, there's still a lot of out-migration from the rural areas, and therefore you can't just say that urbanization is over. But in the third world countries, there's the moving into the center. In the Western world, there's the spreading out, but cities are still growing in influence, and more and more and more, the world is a city world. We talked about the population, the poverty explosion, and the economy of contrast, and we've talked about the fact that family life is changing radically. And what I want to do now, for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, is go back, review, and expand on those statistics. We talked about the family and the economy of contrast. Let's talk about the family for a minute, just for a minute. I know I did say a couple of these things, right? The traditional family, the guy out working, father working, mother at home with the kids, the traditional family form, you've heard the statistics, is going by the boards. 1960, 43% of all homes were like that. In 1985, 7% of all homes are like that. I mentioned that 10% of all households were singles in 1950. Now it's 25%. We talked about that. Another way to put it is this. In the agrarian age of the world, when basically the world was an agricultural world, the basic unit of society was the extended family. In the industrial age, which has been with us for about 200 or 300 years, in the industrial age, the basic unit of society is the nuclear family. But in the technological age, which is what we're moving into now, you know, there's only been 3 basic ages, and we're moving into the 3rd basic age, the technological age, at least in the Western world, the basic unit of society is the individual. Now, that is a fact. You see, the basic building block of society was the extended family, then it was the nuclear family, now it's the individual. And that's the thing you have to come to grips with. Why did we say that in the next 13 years in this country, only 3 out of every 10 new households is going to be consist of a married couple? The answer to that is, first of all, that the divorce rate is so high. We talked about that. What is the divorce rate? I keep reading in the newspaper very different things, saying the divorce rate isn't as high as it used to be, but it's relatively simple to tell you how to go about it. If you just say how many people are getting divorced each year, you got to realize that populations grow, and sometimes the number of divorces can grow without the divorce rate growing. Basically, if I can find a statistic here or two, basically the divorce rate went from 1960 to 1980, the divorce rate went from 2.5 per 1,000 population in 1965. The divorce rate went from 2.5 per 1,000 population in 1965 to 5.3 in 1979. Then it dipped a little bit and went back up to 5.3 in 1981. Then, from 1981 and following, things started to decline. In 1984, it was down to 4.9. Isn't that much better? And now, but then in 1985, it went back to 5.0 and so on. The point we're trying to make is basically the divorce level is not continuing to rise, but it's staying up there. Bottom line, according to the American Demographics magazine, bottom line is that 6 out of every 10 women now in their 30s, whether they've been divorced or not, will go through one divorce. And that means that the American divorce rate is high, like all the Western countries, and it's silly to argue who's higher. It's high and it's staying high. Another reason that the number of singles is increasing so much is because people are waiting in order to marry. This is interesting. Look at how fast this is happening. In 1980, 50% of all American women had never married. In 1980, this is people in their 20s. In 1980, women from 20 to 24, 50% of all women 20 to 24, this is interesting, right, have never married. In 1985, 58.5% of all women 20 to 24 have never married. It's a huge jump, especially when you keep in mind that the number of people in their 20s is decreasing. And therefore, people are waiting longer to get married, and we've heard that too. For all of those reasons, the fact is, more and more households are singles. And the married couple, is slowly, no longer, slowly, rapidly, depends on how you look at it, is being eroded as the basic building block of society. So, when you take a look at all that and put it all together, you say, things are really changing. By the way, when someone says to you, the reason for the divorce rate is because of, women working. Let me talk to you a minute about that. Women in the workplace are increasing a great deal. One thing you got to keep in mind is that studies are awfully hard to judge, but studies have shown that women who work are not necessarily more prone to divorce than women who don't. That's a myth. And I think that's fairly safe to say. The one thing that has been shown is the more mobile a family is, that the more likely there is to be divorce. That is, if a family is far away from relatives and friends, okay, there seems to be some statistical significance between mobility and divorce, but not through women working in divorce. Alan Toffler, in his book The Third Wave, he thinks it's silly to talk about being able to get back to the nuclear family, he says, and yet continue with the technological age. He says this. He says the technology, the information society, is a greater threat to the traditional family than all the abortion laws, gay rights movements, and pornography in the world. I think he's right. He says, in order to save the traditional family, you have to do this. Now, he's not a Christian, of course, but still, he's right. In order to save the traditional family in society, he says this, subsidize manufacturing and block the rise of service industry. White-collar professional and technical workers are always and always have been less family-oriented, more intellectually and psychologically mobile than blue-collar workers. Divorce rates have risen along with the rise in service occupations. Ban the increasingly demassified media. Nuclear families work best when there's a national consensus on information and values, not in a society based on high diversity. Cut the standard of living of the entire society to pre-1955 levels, since affluence makes it possible for single people, divorced people, and other unattached individuals to make it economically. And he goes on, he shows that the roots of the divorce problem and the family erosion are a lot more complex than just, as he says, abortion, gay rights, and pornography. Right? One more thing I'll say. Maybe I ought to take a question or two. One more thing I ought to say. We as Christians have got to be really careful when we talk about the erosion of the family, and when we say in our churches we are going to be family oriented and we are going to support the traditional family. You have to be careful about enshrining the industrial age family, all right, as the traditional family. You have to remember that originally, especially in biblical days, the husband and the wife, the husband didn't go off to work, you understand, and leave the wife at home with the kids. That's a fairly new family form. That's the family form of the industrial age. That's where in industrial age everything specialized and the husband had to pick up and leave his home to go to work. Do you see that? Because in a pre-industrial age, the idea would have been much more that you work there either on the farm or you work there in the craft, and the husband and the wife, you see, both worked and both raised their children and both, their place was in the home. You can't say, well, traditionally a woman's place is in the home. That's silly. Traditionally everybody's place is in the home. Okay, and you have to, it's just a little more complex than people like to make it out. And a lot of churches say, we're going to support the old idea of the family, the traditional family, where the husband leaves the home and the wife stays home with the kids. and that's kind of silly, I hope, you see. Nevertheless, the family's eroding, and Christians have to be very, very, very concerned about it. Questions on what I just said? Yes, David.
Could you just repeat that one statistics of the 1980 women 20 to 24?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yes, I'll just read it. 58.5% of women aged 20 to 24 had never married in 1985, up from just from 50% in just 1980. Okay. In fact, among men and women aged 35 to 39, the share that had never married increased 2%, a faster increase than ever before. Postponement of marriage plus rising divorce numbers means the U.S. will continue to see a single surge. For example, among women aged 39, 21% are currently divorced or separated. All the American women in this country who are age 39, 21% are currently divorced or separated. That's outstanding. A very amazing thing. By the way, one other thing about singles is that when women become singles, they live together. When men become singles, they tend to live alone. It says the median age of men who live alone is 41. The median age of women who live alone is 67. It's kind of interesting. Don't ask me. I would never have told you that except David had me reading from here. It's not all that germane, but it's intriguing. Okay. Other questions on what we just talked about. The family, the eroding family. The individual is the building block of society. Yeah, Tim.
How do you critique Dobson's work and focus on the family then regarding the too simplistic, do you think, regarding Kotler's work?
You know, this, I know this is heresy. Are you talking about his film series? I've never seen a film series. And here I am teaching in seminary. I should have seen this. I've never seen it. I really don't know that I'm... Boy. I all I can say is, in general, yeah, I'm warning you about it. I'm warning you that the idea that we can get back to the traditional family by getting women to stay home and instead of going out to work, and by repealing the pornography laws and that sort of thing, I think that is simplistic, sure. See, what you need is a revival, of course, and a reformation, not just one or the other, but maybe that's implications that we'll talk about. In general, I'm not going to say anything about James Dobson, but in general, I see an awful lot of a very simplistic approach on the part of many evangelicals. Yeah, great.
And some of the weirder but unnamed brands of theonomy that shall remain nameless, except that they're in Valdosta, California.
Right.
They have been trying to push back lately. This is something people may need to be aware of.
All
They've
the
been
way.
Trying to go back to the agrarian family.
Right.
More, and this real weird extended family kind of concept. And we do need to emphasize that while the industrial family where the man goes off work and the wife stays home
right.
is a particular
it's a new form. Right.
We do need to emphasize, you know, the leaving the, you know, that each marriage does set up a new family unit.
Yep, that's right. Now I think I don't know what they're doing out in that place, but I do know that that the church has to probably consider ways in which they can serve as an extended family in the modern society. Because even though we can say there's nothing particularly biblical about the husband leaving and really abdicating childbearing to the wife, there's nothing biblical about that. Neither is there anything biblical about both the husband and the wife abdicating childbearing to strangers. And therefore, I think you have to keep in mind the possibility that rather than saying women should stay home, which I'm not sure that's so biblical to say, we need to talk about recapturing the extended family through the church. So let's think along those lines. There's all sorts of wonderful Christian grandmother types in churches that really we could be pooling our resources. For example, you take a look at Proverbs 31, you look at that woman that everybody likes to talk about. Now, where'd she get the time to do real estate dealing and all that sort of thing? Who was raising her kids? She wasn't at home, you know, on the phone with the kids, you know, running around. She probably had grandparents and aunts and servants and all that sort of thing. It was a big extended family, and her children, she had more freedom because of that, I would say, than your typical industrial nuclear family mother has. And why can't the church recall that? Now, this, in a way, we're getting into implications, but don't you see? The church is called the family of God. Now, we've always said that, but in the modern situation, don't you see that we have to think much more creatively about what that means and draw the riches and resources out that God has put into the church as the family of God? This is exactly what I'm trying to get across this week. Yeah, back there, Bob. Yeah, the reason that the individual is the building block of society is not just an accident of technology. But technology is, what Alvin Toffler is showing is that technology, see, Alvin Toffler in his book, The Third Wave, basically sees all of this as being just a function of technology. We can't help it. We've got this thing called the microprocessor computer, and everything is following. But you're absolutely right. The microprocessor is here, and I really don't know exactly, why it's here at this very time. But the radical individualism, which is based on that worldview we've been talking about, is the real root of why the family's eroded. And that's the reason why, as I maybe said, you need both reformation and revival. Reformation means working on our society, trying to move it away from individualism. But revival, of course, has to do with the change in the person's heart. And they have to go together. Christians have always been either revivalists or reformers, I think. They've either tended to be pietists that just say if we change people's lives, that's all that needs to be done, or else public policy types that say we've got to reform our society and lobby and change the laws and so on. So they both have to go together, and Bob's just making sure we realize we need revival, as well as reformation. The poverty thing, the economy of contrast. Let me say something about that. I didn't really say too much, but this is also very important. Let me reiterate, I think I said this last time, on Wednesday. When I say an economy of contrast, I mean two things in particular. On the one hand, the number of people who are making a lot of money is really increasing. Now, there's so many ways to twist statistics, but for example, from 1978 to 1984, the number of families in this country that in households that had $35,000 or more a year income rose from 29% to 34% in constant 1984 dollars. See, that's important to say. It's not just true that more people were making more money. That's always true of every income bracket. But in constant 1984 dollars, there was a real increase. That's significant. From 29%, that's a fifth, you see. A little over a fourth, up to over a third of all the households in this country moved into that bracket. In the meantime, in the same time period, from 25 million people American people were in poverty in 1978, and in 1984, it was 34 million people in poverty, an increase of 38%. Now, how do you define poverty? Maybe I didn't mention this in here. In some European countries, poverty is defined by simply saying the bottom 5%, the lowest 5% of the people who by income. And of course, that defines poverty in such a way that you could never eradicate it, ever. You'd go forever, and you'd always have somebody who's in the bottom 5%, even if everyone in the country was a millionaire. The American way, which isn't too bad, what they do is they define poverty this way. They find out how much it would take for a family of four to eat just a bare minimum nutritional meal, every day, three times a day for a year. In other words, it's not a lot of food, it's not great food, but just enough so they're not sliding back in health. And then they take how much it would cost to feed that family of four for a year, and then they multiply it by three. And that is the poverty line. Because they are saying that if in this country, now I know it's arbitrary, but at least you see it's not completely relative. In this country, if you spend more than a third of your disposable income on food, you're considered poor. Because the average American spends something like 15% of their disposable income on food. Unfortunately, other countries like India, for example, I understand that the average family spends 70% of its income on food. And that's why you see it is still arbitrary, but it's not totally relative. It's possible for a country to eliminate poverty if you define it that way. Now, the thing you have to realize is that there was a 38% increase of people, you see, that were falling under that poverty line at the same time that there was a 34% increase of people. Well, no, not 34. It went from 29 to 34%. A good increase of people who were moving up. And the reason for that, and I did start to talk about it last time, is that high-tech society destroys the lower middle class. It has to. Because you take a look at the industrial parks. The old industrial parks, manufacturing places, had three kinds of jobs. It had high-income jobs for highly trained people, managers. And it had you know, some, well, not usually, but I mean, it would have some minimum wage jobs. But many jobs, somewhere between $15,000 to $30,000 a year, people could raise a family on that income, who were not high school educated. I mean, we're not college educated, you know. We're not upper crust, upper middle class. Now, that kind of job is dying fast. As I said, I think in 1950, 60% of all the jobs in this country are manufacturing. Now it's 12%, and it's on its way down. Now, manufacturing won't be destroyed forever, but the fact is, because of high tech, even manufacturing kinds of industries are becoming more and more high-tech, and therefore there's less and less people that need to be employed and so on. So what you've got in a typical high-tech industry is very high-paid jobs or people who are pushing brooms for minimum wage. And the fastest growing in a technological society, the service industries grow, in the fastest growing jobs, job markets, not job markets, the fastest growing what? Jobs? Fastest growing job categories in this country are waiters, waitresses, cashiers, people that make very little money. In this country, one half of all the people who live in poverty, one half of all the families that are living in poverty in this country have at least one wage earner. Do you understand that? Okay, if you thought that most of the poor people were on welfare only, that's not true. Okay. In fact, it's rather interesting. I can't give you all this perfectly, but I do know, and I did a study recently on it, of the, say, 19, 20 million people, 19 or 20 million kinds of homes, households in poverty, you can account 50% of them have at least one wage earner. 20% of them have two wage earners, and they're still under the poverty line because they make minimum wage. Okay. Then there's another big section are older people, and there's a big section of folks who are poor that are over 65 that can't work. Then you have a good section of people who are disabled. Then you have a good section of mothers, single women, who are at home with four or five children. And then finally, you've got a rather small group of people, a big section of the poor are children, something like 40% of all the poor people in this country are children, something like that. Then you finally got maybe 500,000 people, which is a very small number, 5% something. Yeah, 500,000 people that we don't know why they're poor. That is, they're not working, they're not disabled, they're not old, they're not mothers who are heads of families, they're not kids, they're not adolescents. What are they doing? We don't know. And I'm not saying that necessarily all the lazy people that we think, many Americans think all the poor are, but there aren't that many of them. Okay. Now, the point is, minimum wage jobs will keep you in poverty. And by the way, I'm not right now making a case for raising the minimum wage. I'm just telling you the facts. Okay. Because of that, the lower middle class is basically eroding. And you almost will have to have a college education in order to make a kind of livable wage for your family. The most important thing to keep in mind is that college and college education, I don't know the statistics on this, but the prices, as some of you certainly know, are increasing at double, triple, quadruple the rate of inflation and the cost of living. Nobody can quite explain why. Difficult to know. But I do know that for the first time in history, the percentage of people in this country who have college education is starting to go down. Because of that, the lower middle class is basically eroding. And you almost will have to have a college education in order to make a kind of livable wage for your family. The most important thing to keep in mind is that college and college education, I don't know the statistics on this, but the prices, as some of you certainly know, are increasing at double, triple, quadruple the rate of inflation and the cost of living. Nobody can quite explain why. Difficult to know. But I do know that for the first time in history, the percentage of people in this country who have college educations is starting to go down. Nationwide, in 1980, in the 1980 census, 15% of all Americans had a college degree or better. Even the most highly college-educated group of people, which is people in age 25 to 29, even there, only 23% of all the whites in that age group have college degrees. 11% of blacks have college degrees in that age group, and lower for Hispanics. What I said about statistics, for the first time, there's a small decrease, finally, for the first time in 50 or 60 years, a decrease in the percentage of people who are getting college educations in this country, just at the time when you've got to have one. In 1985, if you take a look at all the people who are aged 25 to 34, in 1985, 25.2% of all the people in that age group had a college degree. In 1980, it was 27.5%. And that's the first time anyone's been able to find any statistic that indicated that there was actually a decrease in the rate of college education in the country. And the reason for that is because of cost, I'm almost sure. But I can't prove that. Nobody can. And then keep in mind other things on the poverty bit. Because of immigration, because of the rapid aging of the population, because of the massive increase in single women heads of households, single women parent heads of households, which are far and away the poorest households in the country, and because of the loss of the middle class, and probably because of rising health costs not unrelated to the AIDS epidemic, there's going to be a major, major, major catastrophe on the way. That is to say, existing welfare programs, social programs, just will not be able to bear the burdens. No way, ever. Oh, one last thing on economy of contrast. The thing that you're going to see in the next 10 years is a combination of high unemployment and massive labor shortages at the same time. Now, the reason for that is because there are a lot of jobs out there, but because of the technological society and because we change so rapidly, people cannot either move to the areas or be trained fast enough to take up all those jobs. You understand that? The problem is that the places where there are jobs, when the jobs show up, people would have to be picked up and moved and then trained extremely fast. I've got a father-in-law who just recently retired from Westinghouse, and he says that's the biggest problem that corporate business is now facing. There are a lot of jobs, but they cannot train people fast enough. And by the time, it takes 3 or 4 or 5 years for people to say, you know, down in that city, there's a lot of jobs. So that people start to migrate. By that time, the jobs aren't there anymore. Why? Because what's happened is the oil prices fell, and suddenly Houston is destroyed. And now where are the jobs? Why, goodness, that's the place that you just moved away from. They're in Boston. They're all around. Remember just a few years ago, unemployment was rising in Boston, and now all of a sudden, all around the new Silicon Valley East, which the Route 128, suddenly there's all kinds of industries. Well, we better move back to Boston. And you can't do it fast enough. Nobody can do it fast enough. So because of the speed at which jobs will show up, and because most of them take a lot of training and education, and you can't train and educate people fast enough in order to do it, there's going to be massive unemployment and labor shortages at the same time. That's what I mean by an economy of contrast. And you're going to find that little guy in the middle is going to be squeezed out, and there's going to be growth in poverty and growth in affluence at the same time. All right? What do you think about that? Questions, Dave?
Well, I have a question.
Sure.
In the light of what you're saying, that because of the immigration, the increase in single women,
yeah, well.
From how you see it, are you aware of any the current political Democrats, Republicans, is any one of these candidates running for office or any of these parties aware of this, or are you aware of any sort of platform positions that are aware of this impending catastrophe and are going to address it?
No.
Okay.
This is a big subject now. I would suggest, I mentioned this to a couple of people afterwards, after the last lecture, A couple of you chastised me because I haven't been telling you where I've been getting my quotes from or giving you books to read. And why in the world anybody from Westminster wants more books to read? I don't know. You've already got, I don't know how much reading for the course. But let me give you a couple of books in case.
Well, maybe you're running for president.
Yeah, I know. That's right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I would consider my own books. No, I don't have any books. I would suggest, for example, reading Alvin Toffler, The Third Wave. It's a book in 1980, but it's basically full of very helpful, helpful stuff about the future. He's optimistic, though. He thinks it's all great, And he also doesn't deal with the worldview shift. He attributes all the changes to high technology, but it's helpful. A guy who does understand the worldview shift is Peter Berger, and of all the things he's written, some of which is not that easy to understand. Maybe the best one is to read a book by him called The Homeless Mind, in which he tries to explain, here's how the modern person thinks. That's where he comes up with the radical individualism, pluralization. A lot of the stuff you heard me say is just a translation. He's a Rutgers sociologist, German, okay? Pretty well known. If any of you have taken any sociology, you've probably run into him. I would suggest, I've already mentioned, reading Oz Guinness, The Gravedigger File. But more directly, in answer to what David is asking, Peter Berger and Richard John Newhouse wrote a book called To Empower People. It's almost 10 years old now. But what it talks about there, David, is... I should be using this, right? What those two guys talk about there is pretty interesting. Neither of them are writing from an explicitly Christian point of view. They don't say, we're doing this as Christians. But what they try to make this case. They say, look, here's the public world and here's the private world. Okay, here's the private world and here's the public world. It says, how do we bring social coherence? How do we bring coherence to society? He says, the liberals, see, out here you've got things like government, remember, in the public realm, and business, and science, and education, okay, and science. That's, remember, the and in here you've got leisure, and your personal religion, and so on. All right. What Berger and Newhouse say is that liberals have traditionally felt the way to bring social cohesion is to take one of these things out here and deify, like government can do it. Government policies, good legislation, or education. Some people think science will do it. Now, what's interesting is they say that not only liberals, but even conservatives have a tendency to idolize the public sector. A lot of conservatives, he said, idolize big business just the way liberals idolize big government and think that if we give, just like the liberals think, if we give government its head, if we give it full sway and power, it can make for a just society. And a lot of conservatives say, if we can just take our grubby hands off of business and let the free enterprise system work, then we'll have a coherent society. What they say is, look, there are what they call mediating structures, and they mention four of them, four mediating structures that actually bridge between the public and the private. The family, the church, the neighborhood, and voluntary societies, private organizations. And they say that these are the structures that can bring coherence to society. And they suggest some things that have been done elsewhere. For example, in the Netherlands, really under the inspiration of Kuyper, the government takes tax money and gives it to churches to run schools. Why? Because now the way the Dutch did it, and the way Peter Berger and Newhouse are saying is, the government ought to recognize its limits, and the government ought to support the family, the church, the voluntary society, and the neighborhood. You see, and realize that those mediating structures can do education. They can do a lot of socialization processes that the government, the big business, can't do. And the public policy ought to support them. Right now, public policy is hostile, wants to eliminate them, get rid of them. They see them as reactionary, as being barriers. Let's get rid of the family. Let's get rid of the church and so on. These guys are saying the only way to really come to grips with the problems we're facing, the only way we're really going to meet the challenge of the future is for public policy to recognize and support these. See, for example, I think they would say instead of doing the social work, and instead of doing the education, the government ought to identify churches and other sorts of groups, churches, neighborhoods, voluntary associations, and give them money to let them do a lot of this. So, for example, in Holland, I understand, somebody can correct me, the government does run secular schools for people who want secular education. They don't, none of this junk about it being neutral. They know it's secular, and say, here's secular schools for people who want secular schools. And they give money to the Roman Catholic Church to run Catholic schools, and they give money to the Reformed and the Christian Church to run Christian schools. And what they're doing at that point is recognizing that government is not neutral, that these schools aren't neutral, and that they need mediating structures in order to bring coherence to society. So public policy supports the fact that that different organizations in society ought to be doing social work and education, all these other sorts of things. When this book was written, it's called To Empower People, they said in the introduction that both liberals and conservatives are rationalists, and they believe that the Enlightenment makes people idolize either big government or big business. And the author said that they have been attacked by conservatives believing that this is basically a leftist agenda, and by liberals thinking this is basically a conservative agenda, and they say maybe we're onto something. So it's pretty interesting. In other words, they are not, this is not, as Harvey Kahn would say if he was here, and I was reading his lecture on this first week, he was saying that the liberal church is a captive to the ideological left, but the evangelicals to a great degree are captives to the ideological right, and we have to be very, very careful about that. The point is, nobody on the left or the right has any real good solutions for what's coming, and therefore they are not talking to the public about what's coming, I don't think. I think they know what's coming. They either deny it to themselves or else they just cover it over. But because they don't have solutions, they better not bring it up. It's just like in a sermon. You should not raise more snakes than you can kill in a sermon. Right? In other words, you don't raise problems that then you don't have the time to answer in the sermon. Well, that's one of the reasons why a lot of people just aren't talking about it. Frankly. Yeah, John. John Richard Newhouse. Richard John Newhouse. He's a Lutheran minister. Very, very interesting writer. And Peter Berger. And don't ask me if Peter Berger's a Christian. I don't know. He certainly says an awful lot of things that Christians would applaud. That doesn't mean he is. Yeah, Brad.
It doesn't seem to me that idea would really wash with the U.S. initiative on separation. Give a little bit of money to
right.
The church for one little thing, and they haul it for you.
I know.
Actually, what's more dangerous than that is that we don't really, our tradition of church and state has become so perverted.
Yeah.
The danger now is to be if you were a headmaster of a Christian school and someone proposed this idea that the government give you tax money to help run it, you know, I would be very wary about taking it because our precedent is that the government would tell you exactly
right.
What to do.
That's right. See, it would be a real hassle all the way around. We'd be afraid to take it, and they'd be loath to give it.
Right. But in the Dutch system, those parameters are far more clearly defined.
Right. That's absolutely right. I'm not saying that I'm... I'll tell you this much about the book and about that sort of thinking. I think it deserves a lot of exploration. That's all. And what I like is that it doesn't seem to follow just an ideological left or ideological right agenda. Yeah, Scott. No, doesn't. Spoken like a true Southerner. I'm sorry, I saw another hint. Yeah, Alan.
A couple lines after one. Berger does profess to be a Christian. He's a
okay. Interesting.
He's in Boston now, too.
Okay, I didn't know that. All right. He would be retirement age for sure or something by now. Am I wrong on that? Or has he just been writing for an awful long time?
He's just been writing for a long time. He gave the lecture last year.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thinker, yeah. Okay, anybody else on this? A little bit on implications. In a sense, I told you I don't need to spend a lot of time because you're supposed to be thinking about this as we go through. But you're going to be learning while you're here in the next few weeks. You're going to be learning, for example, that the church is the people of God, the body and kingdom of Christ, and the fellowship of the Spirit. That's really basically what you're going to be learning, and most everything else is going to be a subheading under it. If any of you have gotten a chance to get a hold of Ed Clowney's book, Living in Christ's Church, which I was hoping that you would read quickly early on to give you an overview. You know what I'm saying. That book is a kind of one-sitting book. It can be read quickly, and it's an overview of everything else. It's a real compressed version. But stop and think about this. We've already talked a little bit about implications. One of the most important things, when it says the church is the people of God, what you're going to learn there is that God's glory dwells in the midst of the church. That's what it says, Hebrews 12:18, that when the people of God are gathered, so are the angels in heaven gathered. You see, it's the center of the universe there. Jesus Christ is present. And as a result, there is, Ed Clowney brings that out in the book there, as a result, God's presence is real. You know, remember Jacob saw the ladder? And Jesus Christ is saying, I'm the ladder, because at the end of chapter 1 of John, he says, you will see angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man. What does that mean? He says, I'm the ladder between heaven and earth. I'm the link. And we were saying on Wednesday that the main problem with the main problem with the modern mind is that there's that concrete slab between the real and the ideal. There's a concrete slab between ethics and values and metaphysics and God, you see. The modern mind isn't completely inimical. It's not hostile to God as much as it's hostile to the real God, a God that's real and a God that has knock the hole through that concrete slab into reality, into the common everyday world, into the public world, you see. So the idea there is that if we believe that the church is the people of God and that God's glory dwells in the midst, that's something we've got to stress. People can't handle that too well. They don't understand it. And yet, I can't help but think about the man in 1 Corinthians 14, verse 25. It says, when an unbeliever comes in and sees you edifying each other, sees the church really operating, what'll happen? It says the secrets of his heart will be revealed. See, he's always wanted to believe that there really was a hole in the wall. He's always wanted to believe there was a door. See, the secrets of his heart will be revealed and he'll fall down, you see, and he'll confess that God is truly among you. That's what the church ought to be. Because when you read about the church being the people of God, that's very important to keep in mind. God's presence makes us a people. And therefore, we're talking about a culturally pluralistic world. We're talking about the ethnic explosion. There is no doubt that we are going to be taxed. We like to talk in principle about the fact that every tongue and tribe and people and nation should be in the church. But when it comes down to it, we will impose our cultural forms on other people. And we're really just not all that eager and interested in making the kinds of change that need to be done in any church, you know, in order to make sure that the church is multicultural. Absolutely, it's got to be done. And the Bible's always talking about the fact that once you were no people, now you're God's people, which means that the glory of God in our midst is the primary relationship we have between people. A black person and a white person, who are both Christians, have more in common. They have something more fundamentally in common. A rich person and a poor person, who are both Christians, they have something more fundamentally in common than they do with someone in their own homogeneous cultural unit, who's not a Christian, you see. Right? In other words, you're a white man second and you're a Christian first. So you're a poor man second and you're a Christian first. That's the key. And because of that, we can talk about that. It says in Ephesians 2, it says, here's Jew and Gentile, there's two different people. Jesus Christ is our peace and he's made of the two one new man. Your past, your pedigree doesn't matter. You've become one new man. Now, it's easy for us to say that. When it comes right down to it, we continue to impose our cultural standards on other people. And we say, we don't mind them coming in as long as they like our music and they like our style and they like everybody. Our doors are open to everybody, you see, as long as they become like us, to be Christians. And that is certainly not taking, that's certainly not taking seriously what we say here. When you take a look at the church as the kingdom of Christ, for example, we have said that we are agents of the kingdom, and the kingdom means that Jesus Christ's lordship extends over everything, public and private. So we've got to talk about what? We've got to talk about our church showing people how to be disciples in every area of life. We talked about that the other day, didn't we? We've got to radically rethink our discipleship material. We've got to radically rethink how we train people to be Christians. Most of our discipling processes only teach people how to be Christians in the private realm. we also have to keep in mind that we live, now listen, we are not a democracy, we are a kingdom. Now, how does that confront individualism? In a couple of interesting ways. To a certain degree, we ought to be happy for individualism if you're an evangelist. Never before have people been less loyal to denominations and institutions. Never. You understand that? People don't move into town and say, well, since I'm a Lutheran, I ought to go to a Lutheran church. They don't do that. They look around because they're modern and they say, what meets my need? And so there's a certain sense in which, because they're so uprooted and because they're so prone to social transformation, in many ways you can get their attention in a way that you couldn't do it years ago. But on the other hand, we're not a democracy, we're a kingdom, and therefore we're going to have to really be very careful about teaching from the beginning what commitment is, and also teaching church discipline. Church discipline is completely foreign notion to people in this culture. Absolutely foreign. We're going to get our pants suit off. Because they just cannot believe that anybody is, they cannot believe that, that there's a religion or there's a church in which people actually are held accountable. They just go completely against the modern mindset. But we've also got to be careful. We've got to use our discipline in a way that's sensitive to modern sensibilities. We've got to realize that. But at the same time, we have to teach it from the beginning. We have to use it creatively. Individualism may show us, for once, that this every member ministry stuff that we've been talking about is something we've really got to begin practicing in order to even get modern man's attention. Modern man who comes on into the church does not want to sit passively and simply let someone else do the work. And frankly, the Bible says every member's a minister, every member's a prophet, a priest, and a king. The way I would put it is, it's sort of like individualism makes modern Americans, in particular, providentially open to the teaching of lay ministry and every member being a ministry. Hunger for intimacy? There's this tremendous hunger for intimacy. American evangelicals, especially Reformed and Presbyterian types, have never been good at that. They're good at the cognitive, but they're lousy at, you know. I mean, look, take a look. Seriously. The charismatics are growing because there's a providential openness to the intimacy of fellowship that the church can offer and for the spirituality. People are hungry for something supernatural. Very hungry. One of the reasons the charismatics are growing is not because of their weaknesses, because their strengths play to the hungers of this particular society. You know, a guy comes walking off the street into your typical Presbyterian church and says, I've just become a Christian, I was a male hustler. Everybody says, well, first of all, there's no place for them to say that in a typical Presbyterian church. There's no place where we believe in so much spontaneity and unpredictability we even allow testimonies. But if you hear about it, you say, that's very nice. Go sit in that pew over there for at least 10 years. We're going to watch and see whether you turn out all right. But in the Pentecostal church, they'll not only get them up there, they'll start, what a great Christian you're going to be. And they'll hug you and kiss you and get you to work. Why? Because the charismatic church brings out parts of the doctrine of the church, has a good grip on certain parts of ecclesiology that play right into the providential openness of modern man to some of those things. Let me say, I got to stop. But when you go through this entire course, you've got to be constantly saying, how does that relate to the modern challenge? Do we have to practice that more? Do we have to practice it in more creative ways, you see? Do we have a theology of the city? Do we really believe in holistic ministry? So we're ministering to people who are poor and needy. Do we have such an emphasis on family ministry that anyone who's not part of a traditional family really feels excluded? And in our efforts to support the traditional family, which is good, and strengthen traditional family, what about the majority of people who belong to broken family forms? You know, unwed mothers and single parents and the divorced and ex-homosexuals and all the people who have become the majority of the people who are not part of the traditional family, do we have a place for them? Can we minister to them? But how do we do that in such a way that we still strengthen the traditional family? All these things have to be thought through. And you have a lot of work to do in this course. And I don't know why you want other books to read anyway. You got enough books to read as it is. Okay, Monday we start another unit, and that is the history of the doctrine of the church. I'll be doing one lecture, and Claire Davis will be doing the other two. Look at your reading. You're supposed to be starting to do some different kinds of reading.